Police avert a tragedy at the Islamic Center of Northeast Florida, and it's 5 years in prison for former Congresswoman Corrine Brown. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9, and thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We're always live at 9, and make sure to get our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and through our app. Just ahead, a plot for a mass shooting against Jacksonville's Muslim community is foiled. 549-2937 to join the conversation on that. Also ahead, it's the close of a long chapter in the federal corruption trial of former Congresswoman Corrine Brown. And in our movable feast, Lee Court drops in on the Alhambra Dinner Theater's 50th anniversary. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, a local Arlington man is under arrest, charged with planning a mass shooting at the Islamic Center of Northeast Florida. Luckily, law enforcement foiled his terrorist plot. Sheriff Mike Williams joined the FBI and the Florida Department of Law Enforcement Monday to announce the arrest of Bernardino Bolitete. Bolitete told an undercover officer that he hated Muslims, and he outlined his plan to shoot up the local Islamic Center. JSO notified the FBI to ensure the protection of the center, and they arrested Bolitete last week. With his insights into this, we welcome Parvez Ahmed, former chair of the Council on American Islamic Relations and professor at the University of North Florida. Dr. Ahmed, always good to see you. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Let's begin with the positive. Police stopped this man before he could carry out his horrible plot to shoot up the local Islamic center.
Absolutely. And so our gratitude goes out to the law enforcement community for thwarting this attack. And we are obviously very appreciative of how law enforcement came together to stop this crime from taking place. Who knows what the fallout and the damage would be if he was able to go through with this thing. But it does raise the question of why and how these things are happening. And so we cannot forget the big picture at play, that hate crimes are on the rise, hate groups are on the rise, and hate groups in our own community, in the First Coast community, is on the radar of groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center and others. So there's a lot of activity going on over here, and it would be nice if law enforcement can work with the minority communities, racial minorities, religious minorities, sexual orientation, you know, to kind of figure out how these things can be prevented before they become a problem, as it was done in this case. So kudos to the law enforcement community.
Yes. The man they arrested, he confided to a man who he didn't realize was an undercover police officer in a secretly recorded conversation that he hated Muslims and that he was going to conduct a mass shooting on the local Islamic center. And it's not the first time, by the way, the local center has been targeted in this manner.
Right. A few years ago, there was a bomb that was placed in the Islamic center. I was at that time on the board of the Islamic center. It narrowly averted a major damage because the bomb was placed behind a door. It did detonate. But because the door was thick enough that it prevented the blast from coming inside, at that time, worshippers were inside the Islamic Center worshiping when the bomb went off.
This is all happening just as the Supreme Court yesterday affirmed President Trump's travel ban from six Muslim-majority countries for people wanting to travel into this country.
And so notice the irony. The person who has been caught on this plot is not from the six countries that are being banned. None of the people from the six countries have ever committed an act of terrorism in the U.S. So it is part of the feeding frenzy that is creating hatred and suspicion of groups needlessly. It started with the candidacy of Donald Trump. He has made several Islamophobic comments on the campaign trail. Recently, he retweeted a video from a well-known British hate group, the equivalent of Britain's KKK, that not only the videos were spurious, but what they purported to show was not what a U.S. president should be propagating. And we see this in the impact of it because the group subscription after Donald Trump forwarded their video went from about 30,000 subscribers to over 100,000 subscribers. So you can see how the hate metastasizes when political leaders or mainstream political groups give credence to their voice.
In the local Muslim community, What's the discussion in terms of this most recent incident?
People are concerned and people are worried, that a little bit puzzled. Like, his profile, he's from Philippines. He's a green card holder. He's an older gentleman. From that profile, it is really puzzling that why would he be animated by this hate? But my feeling has always been that when hate metastasizes, it does not discriminate between who the perpetrators are and who the victims are. If you foment enough hatred against a group, anybody, whether they fit a profile or do not fit a profile, could be animated by that to act out.
A bond hearing is set for later today at the U.S. District Courthouse in this particular case, as this man faces charges. And so we'll continue to follow the story. Parvez Ahmed with UNF, thank you for being with us this morning.
Thank you, Melissa.
Speaking of the courthouse, another big story today that we're following, the sentencing of former Jacksonville Congresswoman Corrine Brown. It is a 5-year prison sentence for the former Congresswoman. She was convicted on 18 of 22 counts of tax, wire, and mail fraud stemming from her involvement in the bogus charity One Door for Education. Two journalists have covered this trial from the beginning, and they join us now. Nate Monroe of the Florida Times Union and WJCT's own Ryan Bank. Guys, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
Thank you.
And let us know your thoughts on the sentencing of former Congresswoman Corrine Brown by calling us up at 549-2937. Nate, let's begin with you. You broke this story of the former Congresswoman's sham charity. She's received 5 years in federal prison, along with some of her former staffers. They've also received sentences.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting because by the time, you know, we got to yesterday, I don't think that these sentences were shocking necessarily, but they sure would have been hard to have imagined 2 years ago, which is when the stuff, you know, started to seep out into the public consciousness. And, it really was kind of a remarkable fall for Corrine Brown, who just, you know, really was someone who headed, you know, this kind of Democratic Party machine at you know, kind of the height of her power. And, you know, now can't really muster even, you know, enough money to defend herself adequately, it seems like.
It is the sad end to a high-profile political career, Ryan Bank. For many years, Congresswoman Brown carried a lot of weight in this area, and she had leverage in certain aspects of her position on Capitol Hill that she brought to bear for this community.
Well, yeah, and I think that was clear in the proceedings of the trial, when Republicans and Democrats, mega donors, heads of parties, came in and talked about how they had dealings with Corrine Brown and that they trusted her when they gave her donations that were ostensibly supposed to go to One Door for Education, a charity for children, to buy laptops, to take kids on international trips, things of that nature. And, you know, Corrine Brown was someone who was a major figure who kind of defied the odds. This was the narrative that was also talked about in court a lot. She was one of the first African-American women elected to Congress since Reconstruction when she came in 92. And it really is something that even Judge Timothy Corrigan touched on in his decision. His 24-page sentencing decision mentioned how this was a real fall from grace, and it was tragic all the way around.
Let us know your thoughts on the federal sentencing of former Congresswoman Corrine Brown. The number to join the show, 549-2937. Now, yesterday, Ryan, you spoke with Ms. Brown's defense attorney, James Smith, about their team's reaction to the verdict. Here's Smith.
The judge gave me a deadline of next week to file the motion for bond pending appeal, and I think there are good grounds for that. We do think there are some appealable issues where she has a chance of prevailing.
Now, as that appeal goes forward, Nate Monroe, as you've reported, Brown's supporters all along have argued that she was unfairly targeted, and that also high-profile donors that were writing all of these checks to the congresswoman, and as you reported, we learned that money was not flowing to students. It was being used in a slush fund to facilitate trips and dinners and things like that. They've criticized, this has laid bare the process by which donors buy access to a high-profile member of Congress.
Sure. I mean, I've never understood that sort of argument in terms of it being some kind of an exoneration of her. I mean, the judge, you know, essentially rebuked that rationale in his decision yesterday. I mean, Ryan is right that he was very, you know, spoke very sort of highly about her accomplishments, but did not hold back at all about, you know, the nature of her actions. And, you know, I mean, public corruption, that's the nature of public corruption. It's not a violent crime. The whole point is that a corrupt government is not an efficiently run government, and that costs everybody money. I mean, that's why we have corruption laws to begin with. You know, the idea that, you know, there were no, you know, that these donors weren't victims. I mean, I'm not sure that that's going to figure into her appeal at all. I mean, I just don't, you know, I don't see that having any traction whatsoever.
Yeah. And to Nate's point, there was actually quite a swift rebuke in the decision by Judge Timothy Corrigan to that argument, which was put in place quite a few times by her lawyer, James Smith. I think the line here, I actually have it right in front of me, even taking into account the mixed motives of some of the one-door donors, all of them had a right to expect that a substantial portion of their donation would be used for the stated purpose to help children, which obviously it wasn't, or most of it was not. Mm-hmm. So this kind of argument that was being put up by the defense, one of the arguments that was being put up by defense was pretty easily knocked down by the prosecution and by the jury and by the judge.
Wherever people stand on their feelings about Corrine Brown, it is a tragic end to this politician's career here in this area. She will report to prison the first or second week in January, and sentenced to 5 years, Nate, but could serve what? She has to serve 85% of that sentence.
Yeah, and, you know, I think a portion of that could be in, like, some version of, like a halfway house or something, but she wouldn't truly be released until, yeah, 85% is the requirement.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk for a minute about the sentencing for her former legislative aides.
Yeah, so Ronnie Simmons, her former chief of staff, got 4 years in prison. He'll get 3 years of probation and then, you know, quite a bit of restitution he's going to have to pay after that. And that was actually an upward departure by the judge. And his rationale was that he actually believed that Ronnie Simmons was just as culpable as Corrine Brown in this fraud. He was also charged with a completely separate crime of employing his sister as a sort of ghost employee in Corrine's office and using the salary she was paid to sort of enrich himself. Carla Wiley, who had at one time dated Ronnie Simmons, got 1 year and 9 months, and she was sort of the least culpable of the three in the judge's eyes. And you know, I think the facts of the case, what we know, seem to more or less support that.
Let's go to your calls now. Let us know your reaction to the five-year federal prison sentence for former Congresswoman Corrine Brown. Tom on the West Side. Hi, Tom. Good morning.
Ah, yes. Good morning to y'all, too. I was just wondering if how y'all thought this compared with the 8-year sentence that Randall Duke Cunningham of California received for his corruption, which was much more extensive than Corrine's. Not that I condone her actions, but it's just an interesting comparison.
Right. And Cunningham was a Republican member of the House from California. As you said, Tom, he resigned in 2005 and he pleaded guilty to bribery, fraud and tax evasion. So he served, or was sentenced to rather, 8 years, a lengthier sentence than Ms. Brown.
Yeah. And I mean, his convictions were more, I mean, he had, you know, a couple of more serious crimes in there, like bribery. And, you know, the judge in Corrine's case sort of made a point to say that he believed that his sentence for her, based on the comparison of similar crimes, was within the mainstream of sentencing.
Yeah, and I think we also have to be careful. There's a lot of this has been going around since before the sentence was even handed down. This is right after the conviction. But a lot of people comparing different corruption cases or different fraud cases and saying, well, you know, what about this case or what about that case? This person got off easier. This person didn't get off easier. And I think it's really, it's not something that we should be doing. You can't just directly compare each case to each other. There's different factors. There's different judges. There's different juries, different crimes in many cases. So I'm not so sure that's even a real productive way to look at it.
But sadly, there's no shortage of corruption cases to uncover. Yeah, that's certainly true. And let me just close by saying the Times Union in particular has performed its role in this community of informing the public about where their tax dollars are going and holding public officials accountable.
Well, thank you. We appreciate that.
So thank you both for joining us, Nate Monroe of the Times Union and our own Ryan Bank. Much more still ahead later, a look ahead to the jazziest Christmas concert in town. We'll have a live in-studio performance. The Alhambra Theater celebrates 50 years. And big news on the JU campus. We'll tell you about it right after this.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. From the State House to the Everglades to the Panhandle, Florida has a unique story.
So join us every Friday for the Florida Roundup.
And hear from newsmakers, journalists, and Floridians from all across the state
about the issues that matter to you.
The Florida Roundup, Fridays at 1 on WJCT.
I'm John Hockenberry of The Takeaway. The Takeaway is a fast-paced look at the news of the day. It's in-the-moment conversations that take the facts and frame them in ways that make you think. Newsmakers, experts, and people affected by the news, all part of the conversation. The talk is better when there's more at stake. So listen to The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International. Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
Convinced you've heard it all before? Well, at Indie Endeavor, we challenge that notion. Tune into WJCT's After Hours for the best songs you've never listened to. Tuesdays at 11 p.m.
Support for Movable Feast is made possible by 927 Events, event venue and catering.
Welcome back. Big news for Jacksonville University. A new 20,000 square foot, 2.5 million JU Boys and Girls Club near the campus is going to be unveiled in 2019 on land owned by the university. It's another move by the school to strengthen community partnerships and work on the renewal of Arlington. JU President Tim Kost is here, along with Paul Rodriguez, CEO of Boys and Girls Club of Northeast Florida. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Congratulations, first of all. This is exciting news.
Thank you. Any chance we get to partner with Paul Martinez is a good day.
Paul Martinez, rather. And so tell me a little bit about this, because this is something that I had heard had been in the works for some time.
Yes. We've been talking about it for over a year now, and it just came to reality. We were just so excited about this opportunity.
What's going to be in the facility, and how will it serve the community?
Well, it'll become a part of the community, and inside will be teenagers. It seems like that's the segment that's always left out. And we're taking a stand, and teenagers is that's where we're going to be. So inside we'll have robotics, rock climbing wall, all kinds of great programs that the Boys and Girls Clubs provide. But the biggest thing that we're going to have and provide is a sense of belonging, which is what these children need.
Right. And the Boys and Girls Club is famous for that all over the country. It's a safe place for kids to go, to study, to get involved in activities, and have mentors, older adults that care about them. So that's exciting for Arlington.
Absolutely.
And Tim Kost, this is part of an overall effort you've led on as president of Jacksonville University to go beyond the borders of the campus, to renew Arlington. That's a vision I know that you've had for several years now.
Thank you. Yeah, you said it exactly right. Paul and I both graduated from JU back in the early 80s. We were classmates. And as I came back into town to find someone like him who was doing so much for the community at the same time, exactly as you put it, Melissa, we were trying to invest inside our own campus, and at the same time saying, are there other willing partners who might want to make it a safer place, a better place where our students can live and grow and study? And whatever's good for Arlington, I think, is good for the city of Jacksonville. It's certainly good for Jacksonville University. And mm-hmm. you get a chance like this one where we had a piece of land and Paul had some aspirations and we're great, great partners together. I think this one's going to be exciting come 2019. Between now and then, hopefully, well, the university will have a chance to speak with you and others about other things we're doing like this.
Yeah, this is just one of a lot of moving parts, I know, that you're working on at JU. Now, you've already raised, what, $1 million for this project?
Correct.
Where do things stand in terms of dirt turning, building this facility?
Well, right now we're in the architectural stage, and by the end of next year, we'll have all of the dollars raised, and then they'll begin. It's going to be a metal building, and if you saw, it was in the Times Union today, a photograph of it, and it's just an amazing-looking building.
Yeah. It's going to be a showplace from the renderings I've seen. And that's exciting.
Absolutely.
Because, Arlington is like so many other inner ring communities and cities across this country that used to be seen as the place to be, the place to live. And then over the decades, they saw decline. And now there's this amazing effort. You're at the forefront of this in Jacksonville, Tim, but all over America, there's this effort to bring these inner ring communities back to vibrancy.
Right. And there are lots of great examples of this. Some places that my wife Stephanie and I have lived. If you look at, they've done wonderful work in DeLand with Stetson. They've done great work in Winston-Salem with Wake Forest. We believe there's an important role the private university can play, whether it's partnering with the sheriff, whether it's partnering with the mayor, whether it's partnering with the Paul Martinez type talent that's in this town. You're now starting to get private investors looking at Arlington in a different way. It's the natural evolution. What we're trying to do is create a safe and nurturing collegiate village all around our area in Arlington. It's very exciting right now.
And which kids will be eligible to come, and how will the extracurricular activities unfold? What will be part of the plan in this new center for kids that are part of it?
Well, it'll be from 12 to 18. And if we've done what we're supposed to do when they've left, when they graduate high school and they shake that principal's hand, we believe that we will have been part of that. And we're gonna teach them about entrepreneurship, the opportunities of the military, the opportunities of going to college. It'll be great.
And Melissa, if you think to dovetail that, if I can, think about the things we teach on campus, and we're teaching it to sort of an 18 to 24 year old undergraduate crowd. And then the graduate students, masters and doctorates. When Paul and I talked, we were shooting hoops one day over at his gym, and we got talking about, is there something our university can do? The professors who might want to be involved in everything from cyber to robotics to entrepreneurship to mental health counseling to kinesia. That's all stuff we teach.
Yeah.
So you're talking about something that's literally across the street from our football stadium. Our faculty can walk over there. Our students can go over there. We have an entire education department that can engage there. So you're into kind of the programmatic world of a university working with a Boys and Girls Club. So we think we're charting some new turf here.
Definitely. And two strong entities coming together is always a good thing. The Boys and Girls Club, how many facilities across the area? And for those that aren't familiar with the role of the Boys and Girls Club in this community, could you talk a little bit about that, Paul, the important work you're doing in neighborhoods across Jacksonville?
So we're in that after-school space from when kids get out of school till around 7 or 8 o'clock, which is the time that we're needed the most because the majority of our kids come from single-parent households, so the family is working and there's not a place for them to be. So we help them on an average day. We help them with their homework. We give them a meal. And then we help educate. That's the big thing, and mm-hmm. make impressions in their lives. We have 25 clubs here in Jacksonville area.
25?
Yeah, 15 after school based, and then 10 freestanding.
And this will be the 26th.
Correct.
It sounds like. A little ways off, but exciting news to share with our listeners. So thank you both so much for being with us. Jacksonville University President Tim Kost and Paul Martinez of the Boys and Girls Club of Northeast Florida. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, he's the beloved local impresario who brought Jacksonville's Alhambra Theater back from closure. Craig Smith has packed the place ever since with audiences, great food, and great shows. The Alhambra is the oldest dinner theater in America, and it's celebrating 50 years on the First Coast. In today's Movable Feast, our look at dining and hospitality trends across the region, Lee Court of the Women's Food Alliance talks with Smith about the Alhambra's legacy.
banana. Try the salami, Tommy. Give it to Gravy Davy. Everybody eats when they come to my house.
Let's go behind the scenes today with Craig Smith at the Alhambra Dinner Theater in Jacksonville. Welcome, Craig. And I just found out that you were one of Melissa Ross's very first guests on her show.
I was. When we first acquired the theater in October of 2009, she was gracious enough to have me on. And we had a good time talking about the theater and what was going to happen. And I look back on it, at that time I had great nerves and anxiety about whether or not this would actually work. And here we are in 2017, and you can't get a seat from now till January.
It's an amazing experience going to the Alhambra, especially under your new reign. Why the Alhambra? Why dinner theater? Why theater for you? You could have done anything in any industry. What is it about the theater and food that really has your total interest and your personal touch?
Well, you know, I've always kind of been a hospitality hound, if you would. I knew how I liked to be treated and the things that I enjoyed. And, you know, when the Alhambra closed, I've told this story so many times, I just got a random phone call from the son of the owner looking for a job. That was on a Wednesday evening. On Friday afternoon at 4 o'clock, I agreed to buy it. And in no small part because of my daughter and my family's love for the Alhambra. I always thought I knew how to make it good, right? Just treat people nice, feed them good food, and make sure they have a good time. And that's what we did. And I'm proud to tell you this year we'll host almost 150,000 people at the Alhambra.
150,000 people. With how many shows during the season?
Nine shows. This year we did eight. This was our 50th anniversary year. The theater actually opened in December of 1967.
Now, there's some real history with having an equity union dinner theater in America. I don't think there are many left in the country. Tell me about the history.
There's not a whole lot of equity theaters left. So, you know, back in the 60s, when an actor left their television show, they got no residuals. They were just done making money at that point. They had no income. And so they kind of had the dinner theater circuit, maybe 170 dinner theaters around the country, and they would just take their shows, you know, the guys from Hogan's Heroes and the guys from the Brady Bunch, you name it, right? All the famous names have been to the Alhambra. And so that was kind of how they made their living. And, you know, as Alan Alda was probably the guy that really kind of changed all that from MASH, you know, he really got the residuals going and that kind of thing. And so then that need wasn't there. They started doing commercials. Actors didn't do commercials. You know, they used to have the little jingles and such. And so in the 70s, all that began to change, late 70s. And so the need for dinner theater went away. And quite frankly, what they tell me, of course, it's long before my time, they tell me that, you know, the shows weren't all that great. And they were just writing shows just to have actors have something to do.
But today, we come to the Alhambra, and there's such a new, there's like a renaissance of the ambiance, the food, the quality of the shows. But a behind-the-scenes question, every time I'm there, there are people that I meet or sit next to, which is a fun experience unto itself. You don't have to go with your whole table. You can be seated with other people who become friends by the end of dinner and show. And they are wondering how local people actually audition to be in these celebrity-driven shows, because every time I go, there is another big-name celebrity in your show.
So believe it or not, about half of our cast are equity cast or union cast, including our stars. And then we have open auditions for every single show. We go to New York in November, December and audition for all of the principal roles. And then we do local auditions. And quite frankly, one of the best finds that we found in a lot of years was a local young lady who came out and auditioned. And she's probably done six shows with us. Our current show, The Addams Family, we probably have 8 of the 21 cast members have multiple Broadway credits. The lead, Carlos, has 8 different Broadway shows that he's done.
Now, one of the big debuts to me and to all of your fans is the amazing food service, the dinners, the food. Firstly, they're themed for the show, which I love. And then there's a cocktail in your library bar that's themed to the show, which is fun. But talk about Chef Dewan Roy.
He is one of the finest guys you'll ever meet. He's exceedingly talented in the kitchen, and he's just a good guy. We were auctioned off at the diabetes function Saturday evening for him to come to your house and cook and me serve, and we were auctioned off for $2,500.
Killer.
And he
so
said,
they get him as the chef and you as the
and
server.
And me as the waiter, and he looked at me and said, "Boss, you sure don't get much for your money these days, do you?" But he's a wonderful guy, really talented. Very rarely does anybody ever have anything but effusive praise for our culinary program. Quite frequently, people will say to me, the prime rib or the Parmesan crusted salmon is two of the best meals in Jacksonville. I've probably got 1,000 emails that have said that. There's two places I got great inspiration from: the Jacksonville Suns, when I worked there as a young man, and the Ritz-Carlton Company. Now, those are about as two opposite ends as you can get. But so many things we do at the theater, I gleaned from one of those two places in my life. And certainly just try to be ladies and gentlemen serving ladies and gentlemen.
Absolutely. Well, you enliven that mission. But that's truly hospitality. And the Movable Feast is so happy to have you. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
I can't wait till the Christmas show and put on my famous winter Christmas sweater and enjoy whatever's going to be on the menu from Chef. And thank you, Craig Smith, Alhambra Dinner Theater in Jacksonville, Florida.
Thank you. I appreciate you.
Everybody eats when they come to mind.
And we'll be right back.
WJCTnews.org is your source for the latest local, national, and international news 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Podcasts of your favorite local stories and shows, the WJCT First Read every weekday morning, and playlists from all of our after-hours music programming. From your computer or mobile device, see it all at WJCTnews.org.
Hey, Car Talk fans, if you're wondering why Click and Clack aren't here, NPR is no longer distributing the best of Car Talk. The good news is you can continue to listen to the podcasts of the program at cartalk.com. We hope you enjoy WJCT's new weekend schedule. For more information about the new programs, visit wjct.org/weekends.
Samora Pender Hughes has a message.
I'm not trying to just sit at my piano and write music. I'm trying to say, how can I be most of use?
Next time on Jazz Night in America, the young composer, pianist, activist takes his transformation suite to his hometown of Berkeley, California. It's music, poetry, and a call to action. I'm Christian McBride.
Saturdays at 8 on 89.9 WJCT.
Many people in Jacksonville never come in contact with those outside their core communities. WJCT is embarking on a journey called Beyond the Core to start a citywide conversation about what unites the people who call Duval County home and what makes our smaller communities unique. We might have an upcoming Beyond the Core listening event in your neighborhood. Check WJCTnews.org to find out.
Welcome back. Well, computing occupations are the number one source of all new wages in this country, and they make up 2/3 of all projected new jobs in STEM fields. Computer science is one of the most in-demand college degrees, but not enough computer science graduates are coming out of our high schools and colleges. That's a problem. Less than 3,000 high school students in Florida took the AP Computer Science exam last year, and universities didn't graduate a single new teacher last year prepared to teach computer science. Now, this week marks Computer Science Education Week in the U.S., and you can be part of it right here in Jacksonville. Kathleen Schofield is Director of Programs and Policy with the Northeast Florida Regional STEM Hub. And she's here with more. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
And in a minute, we'll talk about all the exciting stuff that's happening around this in Jacksonville this week. But first, we are not doing a good job preparing students for instruction and careers in this field of computer science. That's a problem.
It is a problem, but I've got some great news to report today. I was at the national kickoff event in Silicon Valley yesterday for Computer Science Education Week, and governors from different states are getting very active, and I might say a little competitive. Our governor, Rick Scott, has committed $15 million for the Florida Future Workforce through Coding and Computer Science program.
Wow.
And this is a brand new program that he has put into the budget for next year.
That's excellent, because clearly training more students for STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and math, is critical. We need a workforce that knows how to code, understands computer science. Let's talk about code.org. What is code.org?
Code.org was established 4 years ago by Hadi Partovi, who was a Silicon Valley computer scientist, and he realized that not enough kids were getting interested in computer science. And he had a revelation. He thought, if we could just get kids to try and code for 1 hour, then we could really change things up. Mm-hmm. And he formed a nonprofit and got some backing from not only the federal government when they agreed to name National Computer Science Week as the first week in December, but also a lot of funding from people like Microsoft and Google. And as a result, we've been able to really change the projection for computer science here in Northeast Florida. We have events going on, hundreds of events in our region right now. And I'd like to tell you what's going on at the MOSH this week.
Sure.
Through our STEM ecosystem work, we've done a great job of connecting partners. And Duval County Public Schools is hosting an event at the MOSH today, tomorrow, and even Thursday. Today, there'll be Minecraft Heroes Journey with Northwestern and Kirby Smith Middle Schools. And we'll have sixth grade students writing code in Minecraft. Tomorrow, we're having a hackathon. And
nice. What's a hackathon?
Well, a hackathon is where you are trying to address a problem by creating an app or a website. And our problem is, pretend we've got extraterrestrial hackathon going on. Aliens are invading Jacksonville.
Nice.
Yes, and this is an emergency response hackathon. The kids who are going to participate will be developing an app to try to solve how to interact with these aliens and how to make sure that we are having a safe environment in this alien attack. And they're going to try to solve that with computer science and coding. Then Thursday is my personal favorite, Code Like a Girl. And we will have middle school girls coming to code. We've got Jane Landon from code.org is coming and bringing some of her female software engineers to inspire these girls.
That's fabulous, because we need more girls to get into STEM fields. There's a big gap. So this is a way for young girls to get excited about this. Now, with both of these events, who is eligible to attend? What's the age range for kids? How can they be part of this, Kathleen?
Okay, well, at these particular events, we're targeting all grade levels. Code Like a Girl will include elementary students. The hackathon is going to be geared towards middle and high school students. And the event today, the Minecraft, is also targeted at middle school students. But all around the region, there are literally hundreds of events going on that include kindergartners coding, high school kids coding. Everyone is encouraged to have a code event this week.
Yeah, anyone can host an hour of code, Kathleen says. If you just go to code.org, you can get the materials to do this, right?
Absolutely. And they're targeted for every grade level, readers and non-readers. And it's not too late to sign up for an hour of code.
Now, this isn't just kids we're talking about, too. Anyone can learn to code at any age or stage of life. I would like to learn how to code. I wish I had been taught this when I was younger.
Yes, me too. I wish I knew about it when I was younger. And anyone can go on code.org and access these fun tutorials to learn how to code. Additionally, we are doing some parent events in the winter season and going into the spring to help parents not only learn how to code, but learn how to support their kids and gear them towards one of these very lucrative careers.
Speaking of which, Florida has more than 20,000 open computing jobs. These are high-paying jobs with great long-term earning potential. But we only graduated in this state about 2,500 computer science graduates. So a huge number of opportunities out there and not enough young graduates to fill them.
That's exactly correct. And between our work with the STEM ecosystem and with STEM2Hub organizing across the region to bring these different partners together to enhance opportunities for kids, we're really hoping to put a dent in that and attract more children to computer science jobs and get them interested in the field.
Now, tell me a little more about the Northeast Florida Regional STEM2Hub and how it works.
Well, thank you. The STEM2Hub was formed a couple years ago by Gary Chartrand and by a group of our Jacksonville corporations who know that a lot of those 24,000 jobs are right here in Jacksonville. And because they were having trouble filling those jobs, we all decided if we work together with our college presidents, our school district superintendents, and our corporate partners, that we would be able to connect opportunities and educate children about the opportunities that exist in these computer science fields. Mm-hmm.
How can more families get their kids involved in the STEM2Hub? And how can they encourage their children, particularly their girl kid children, to get interested in this as a potential path for them in life?
That's a great question. I want to point out that we're working with the Girl Scouts of Gateway Council. Mary Ann Jacobs attends a lot of our ecosystem meetings, and we've started many Girl Scout troops around the region. We also work with the Boys and Girls Clubs so that we can get robotics and coding into their programs. So there's a lot of in-school and after-school activities. This weekend, there'll be Hour of Code activities going on at the Microsoft Store over in Jacksonville. And if you visit our website at stem2hub.org, you can see places where exciting things are going on that kids and parents can get involved with.
And it's exciting to note, this is the first year that AP Computer Science is also being taught in every Duval County High School.
Yes, and we're very excited about that. Last year, there was one school offering that. And this year, just about every Duval County High School is offering advanced placement computer science principles. It's a huge step forward, and we've got a ways to go.
We do, but better late than never.
Absolutely.
And in the meantime, as Kathleen said, the hackathon is happening at Mosh tomorrow night. Too late for kids to register?
It's actually tomorrow from 8:30 to 1 o'clock.
Tomorrow morning.
Yes, it's tomorrow morning. And there are events going on today and Thursday as well at the same time. And while it might be too late to register a team, anyone is welcome to come on over to the Mosh and check it out.
It's Computer Science Ed Week in America. Learn more about the local events going on by visiting the local STEM2Hub on the internet. And speaking of coding, she is a girl who codes, a woman who codes, Kathleen Schofield from the city's Northeast Florida STEM2Hub. Thanks for sharing this so much. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
All right. And a quick break. When we come back, are you in the mood for a little jazz, maybe a little holiday jazz? We'll tell you about Jazzy Noel happening this weekend. That's in a moment.
Hendrix Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
Michael Cavendish and Cavendish Partners, PA. Intelligent management of lawsuits for companies, investors, and executives. Offices in downtown Jacksonville. On the web at cavpartners.com.
Net neutrality is the biggest policy fight right now at the Federal Communications Commission. Dropping these regulations on internet providers would be a big win for companies like AT&T and Comcast. What does this mean for you? FCC Commissioner Brendan Carr takes your questions next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
On the next Fresh Air, Guillermo del Toro talks about directing his new film, The Shape of Water. He also directed Pan's Labyrinth. And Cullen Murphy describes growing up the son of a comic strip artist during the golden age of the Sunday newspaper comics. His father drew the popular Prince Valiant strip, which Cullen eventually wrote. He has a new memoir. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
I'm Marco Werman. The World's Newsroom brings you the big picture stories and some other stuff.
It may surprise you to learn, but in Italy, many, many mafiosi are religious.
You don't expect to find a swimming pool in the middle of the desert.
The rule number one when planning a golf course in China is to not call it a golf course.
Join us and hear the world this afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Finally this hour, if you are in the mood for some jazzy Christmas tunes, come on out to Jazzy Knoll this weekend. The concert will feature 19-year-old JU freshman Skylar Nolan, a graduate of Douglas Anderson School of the Arts and a rising jazz prodigy. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you. How are you today?
Good to see you.
It's good to see you as well.
And this is really exciting. You received a full ride to JU to major in jazz studies, commercial music, and you're studying under John Ricci on the JU campus.
Yes, ma'am.
So a great music program there.
Fantastic. John Ricci and Chris Creswell are like amazing.
Okay, so this is going to be a saxophonist concert from you, Skylar Nolan, and friends. You're going to put a jazz spin on some Christmas classics.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
So this is a little different than going to a church to hear traditional holiday carols.
Yeah, this is more of a, like, I go to that church personally, but this church is more hosting the event, and we're just kind of playing there. They're just the venue, basically.
And this is the Unity Church of Jacksonville, 634 Lomax Street. This concert is coming up Saturday night.
Yes, ma'am. Saturday, 7 to 9.
Now, is this the first time you've done something like this?
No, I did this 2 years ago. It was my junior year of high school, and it was when I first moved to Jacksonville. It was so much fun. I had John Lumpkin, who's one of the biggest names in Jacksonville, one of the best drummers I've ever met, and it was an amazing concert.
What do you like about the saxophone?
It's like an extension of myself, honestly. I love music, all kinds of music. I listen to everything, and I just feel like I can portray that through the saxophone.
Yeah, and jazz is always fun, but at the holidays, it's, you know, kind of a little extra something, I guess.
It's the time, I personally think of it as the time of year when normal people actually listen to jazz.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because a lot of the Christmas songs have a lot of jazz influence.
Sure.
And not many people really listen to jazz very often. I think it's a good way to get jazz in the more commercial and more public eye.
Right. Get it into the mainstream.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, we're going to do that right now. We have a little bit of a preview of Skylar's Jazzy Knoll concert Saturday night. What are you going to be playing for us?
A little bit of Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, you know, because Christmas time.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
Very nice.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And it's not too late to get tickets for Jazzy Knoll coming up Saturday night, December 9th, at the Unity Church of Jacksonville at 634 Lomax Street. Tickets are $10. You can purchase them at the Unity Bookstore this week, or, as people in this town like to do, right there the night of the show. I think you'll get a lot of walk-ups. What do you think?
I think so. I mean, that's what I always do whenever I go to concerts. It's cheaper usually to do it beforehand, but I don't. I always do it at the door.
Well, good luck. I'm sure you'll have a wonderful career in music, and thanks for playing a little music with us.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
He's saxophonist Skylar Nolan and friends. Saturday night at Unity Church, it's Jazzy Noel, as they put a little jazzy spin on Christmas classics. Well, that's our show today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merschart. Michelle Corum runs the board during the hour. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chepchik. And if you missed any portion of today's show, don't miss the rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. Next on 1A, what do you want to ask an FCC commissioner? That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.